How will the individual candidates in the 2025 federal election fare when it comes to retaliating against President Trump's tariff and annexation threats? How will the candidates pursue an independent foreign policy that has been compromised by our involvement in the U.S. Northern Command? How would the candidates address Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people so as to act in concert with international law and in solidarity with the people of Palestine? How has the country's sovereignty already been compromised as a result of past actions of the Canadian federal government? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we feature appearances by some of the candidates in the Canadian elections as they situate themselves and their positions in time for the April 28th national vote. We start our show with one-by-one discussions with three of the candidates for the riding of Winnipeg Centre, which houses radio station CKUW. Then we play back excerpts of the discussion from 2018 with Saskatchewan-based farmer, political activist, and two-time contender for leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, David Orchard, about how Canada is in the same position in 2017 as the Canadian colonies were back in 1866, and now, like then, pulling out of free trade with the U.S. would be to the advantage of those above the 49th parallel. On this week's program, Election 2025, Part 1, Canadian Sovereignty at Stake, interviews with politicians and David Orchard. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 11th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We acknowledge European settlers to this land broke the rights of the indigenous peoples who were here first through false promises, broken treaties, and force, and resulted in crimes of colonialism and genocide toward a people. Let us strive in the days ahead to acknowledge the crimes of the past and the present and right those wrongs through reconciliation and pay reparations so that we can begin to move forward in the spirit of a respectful partnership in the days ahead. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The imposition of these tariffs will cause damage to the economies of all nations of the world. It is best seen as an effort by a handful of elites in the U.S. and globally to destroy the entire global trade system and with it the global economy. They will do so because they think they, a tiny handful of families, will benefit. They start this war smaller nations like Vietnam that lack economic scale and technological sophistication and whose government officials can be easily bribed and intimidated. They intend to destroy these nations completely and make them into virtual slave states. That comes from the article, The Tariff War, First Step Towards a Slave Society, Emmanuel Pastriche, by Emmanuel Pastriche, posted April 9th, originally published on Shingitsu News. The goal of Elon Musk's DOGE, or Department of Government Efficiency, is to reduce the deficit by reducing budget expenditures. But Musk now acknowledges that the DOGE team's efforts will probably cut expenses by only $1 trillion, not the $2 trillion originally projected. That will leave a nearly $1 trillion deficit that will have to be covered by more borrowing, and the debt tsunami will continue to grow. Rather than modeling the economy on McKinley, President Trump might do well to model it on our first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, whose debt-free greenbacks saved the country from a crippling war debt to British-backed bankers, and whose policies laid the foundation for national economic resilience in the coming decades. Just, quote, printing the money, unquote, can be and has been done sustainably by directing the new funds into generating new GDP, and there are compelling historical examples of that approach. That comes from the article McKinley or Lincoln, Tariffs versus Greenbacks, Ellen Brown, by Ellen Brown, posted April 9th, first posted as an original to sheerpost.com. The Kremlin has categorically stated that its goals were, quote, demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine, unquote, as a condition for ensuring Russia's security. And there are valid signs that Russia could agree to ceasefire as proposed by U.S. President Donald Trump, amid suggestion to hold negotiations with Washington and most probably prospective suggestions by China, India, Brazil, and South Africa. These staunch members of BRICS Plus Association have been unsuccessful during the past couple of years to convince Russia on their platform to accept their peace efforts, even as, quote, resolving conflicts by diplomacy and through negotiations, unquote, stated in their annual summit declarations. Russian President Vladimir Putin has made outstanding claims that pathways by the BRICS Plus members to making peace in Ukraine were acceptable for Moscow. Simply, there could not be implemented due to the fact that the Kremlin's requirements and conditions were not taken into consideration. That comes from the article Global Vacancy, Russia-Ukraine Peacemaker, by Kester Ken Klomega, posted April 9th. The situation in British cities has been deteriorating for several years. Birmingham was forced into bankruptcy during September 2023 when the city council blamed the settlement of a gender discrimination case for the financial shortfall. In an April 9th article published by the Times of London, it says that the so-called, quote, bin strikes, unquote, could easily spread to other municipalities. The settlements of unequal pay claims are being cited as the source of the crisis. Nonetheless, the capacity of the British government under both Conservative and Labour administrations has drastically declined in regard to the ability to address the deteriorating living conditions of the working class and impoverished. That comes from the article Birmingham Sanitation Strike Spawns Public Health Emergency in Second Largest Municipality in Britain, by Abiyomi Ezekiwe, posted April 9th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Canadian federal election is underway. This week, we spoke to the candidates of the riding of Winnipeg Centre, which houses CKUW 95.9 FM. So, here we go.
My name is Gary Gervais. I'm running for the Green Party in Winnipeg Centre. And the Green Party, as you may expect, priority is environment, climate, and especially this campaign where it seems to have fallen off the issues list. I think it's more important than ever to vote for Green. We have kind of urgent matters with global trade and what the Americans are doing, but the important long-term matter, I believe, is climate change and environmental issues, and that's why I would encourage people to vote Green.
Okay. Now, the Trump administration is leveling tariffs mm-hmm. against Canada and is even threatened mm-hmm. to annex our country. Yeah. A lot of people would argue, well, under those circumstances, we should not be purchasing military arms from the United States, including the F-35 fighter jets, air surveillance craft, the naval destroyers, refueling jets, and drones. What is your party's stance in terms of whether or not we should be purchasing military items from the United States at this time?
Yeah, so in general, the Green Party's for less military procurement and less purchases overall. I mean, you know, peace is a core value of the Green Party. And so in general, I think we need to reduce our military spending. You know, in this context where we're seeing threats, I think that changes a little bit. I mean, it's obviously a complex issue. Like, are those threats real? If they are, then I think, you know, we have to be thinking about security. And that's where the Green Party came out and earlier in the campaign and announced that we have a civil peace corps be established, which is something new and the other parties aren't talking about. And that would be respond to any kind of crisis, you know. So, for example, you know, forest fire crisis, you know, sort of a mobilization, a force that could be mobilized in kind of those kind of crises. So I think that would support security in a number of ways.
Well, the Trump administration is basically, we're under attack from the Trump administration. Yeah. And the body known as NATO is actually a U.S.-led organization. So, considering that, would you be in favor of withdrawing out of NATO, or at least not being, you know, feeling the need to prop up the same level of support for NATO, especially considering that NATO has led the country into wars that destroyed Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Libya?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's complicated, and especially given that, you know, we have to think in this time while we're under threat about aligning with other partners around the world. And I think NATO could be one of those vehicles because, you know, it's mostly a European alliance. So I don't think withdrawing from it necessarily solves our problem of dealing with the U.S. So I don't think that we should have a knee-jerk reaction based on a president in the U.S. who we don't really know what he wants to do. So I think we have to be careful. I think we have to be a little more patient with some of these issues, as opposed to, you know, we don't know. The Americans don't know. No one knows is he serious about any of his threats. We have to be on guard, but I don't think we should be making knee-jerk reactions.
Okay. Canada entered into the U.S. Northern Command back in 2006, I believe it was, and under this auspices, NORAD was enabled to expand beyond the control of the air and space, but also land and sea. And this is a concern for some that we're essentially losing control over our policy, considering the United States, a general in the United States can command to send their troops onto Canadian soil without the explicit support of the Canadian government. How could we pursue an independent foreign policy as long as we are under the auspices of the U.S. Northern Command?
Yeah, and, you know, the game has changed a bit if we're seeing a threat from the United States. So under agreements like this where we saw them as our neighbor and our ally, maybe we were doing it naively, but I think there was less threat. Now I think we have to take seriously that there is more threat with the U.S. Or, you know, are they going to do things that aren't in our best interest? You know, still probably highly unlikely they're going to do something like that. But it also touches on issues of where Arctic sovereignty is going to become more and more of an issue with climate change and, you know, trade routes opening up in the north, which, again, goes back to the critical long-term issue is really climate change. A lot of these short-term problems, especially with a president who changes his mind every hour, we have to, I think, have our sights more than ever on the long-term.
Okay. The United Nations had declared that the Israeli regime is an apartheid regime, and on the part of their treatment of the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And the Trudeau and Carney governments did not issue any punishment or censure or isolation against them for their practices in terms of what Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and have called a genocide. So what would your government do if it was in a position to prevent what effectively is a genocide of the Israeli, of the Palestinian people?
Yeah, the Green Party's come out strong and said that they support the Palestinian people and Palestine as a state. So I think we're pretty clear on that position. In terms of what we do in form government, Green Party obviously is unlikely to be in government, but it will continue as it has done, even with its limited influence in Parliament, to push for that and to accept the United Nations resolutions around Palestine.
Is there anything you'd like to say just as we conclude in terms of where the Green Party stands and in terms of all the issues that I just discussed?
I think we've covered them well. But again, I think it's really easy to get caught up in the short term, right? And, markets crashing and everyone's focused on that, or, how do we retaliate against a trade tariff? You know, free trade. I remember my first federal election to vote in was the 1988 election, when free trade was the main issue on the ballot. And so free trade, is still relatively in the Canadian context, a new concept. Yet the main parties are all fighting so hard against, pulling back from free trade. So a lot of this is kind of knee jerk. And Green Party's always stood for fair trade, right? So I think, again, we have to think about this in a bigger context.
Leah Gazan, I'm running for re-election as the Member of Parliament for Winnipeg Centre, and I am running under the NDP banner. Since being elected in Winnipeg Centre, we've achieved record investments, even being in the fourth party. I think it's important to have a strong opposition. We see what's happened in the United States in a two-party system. Dissenting voices and voices that push for community, folks that actually live in the community, are really important at this time. We've had over $440 million invested in Winnipeg Centre in infrastructure and new builds. We've had over $122 million just to tackle the issue of houselessness. I think at a time where we see growing authoritarianism south of the border, threats of tariffs, it's important to elect people with experience. I certainly have that experience, particularly representing the very acute issues in our area, working alongside with the community, being led by the community, and I hope to continue doing that.
Okay. The Trump administration has hit us with tariffs and has actually made threats of annexing our country. Now, a lot of people will argue, well, we should just halt all purchases of military arms, including the F-35s, the air surveillance crafts, the refueling jets, drones, naval destroyers. Could you maybe explain your own stance in terms of halting all such weapons purchases?
Well, what I can say is that, we're in an affordability crisis. We need to make sure that our investments are focused on people and making sure they can get through this difficult time. That's one of the reasons why the NDP has proposed, along with the unions, a greater protection for unions, greater protection for workers. One thing I fought for a long time, for example, is a guaranteed livable basic income. For folks, we know that we have income guarantees in this country. I have to say that they're not livable. We need to make our current income guarantees livable and expand them out for those that are falling through the cracks. Poverty is a policy choice. the kind of choices we make in terms of where we spend money, those are policy choices. I will continue to champion, along with our community, anti-poverty initiatives. Hopefully one day we'll realize more of that in Canada, including expanding the PharmaCare plan, including expanding dental care, including putting in place a guaranteed livable basic income for all.
You know, Trump has basically made threats against our country. And I mean, I guess, you know, stemming from that, I mean, we've been made to hype up our spending on defense. And yet we belong to NATO, which is, you know, essentially it's mostly run by the United States. I know it's a whole collaboration. And NATO has also been responsible for wars in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Libya, which basically destroyed those countries. How would you favor getting us out of NATO? And if not, how do you sculpt that in terms of what your party represents?
So what I can say is you can't play footsie with a fascist. You can't play footsie with authoritarian leaders. I've certainly come out publicly and said that. You know, Canada has to take strong positions right now. We need a Canada-led approach, a unified approach, and it cannot be led by authoritarian leaders. I've certainly called for an arms embargo on the state of Israel, you know, a ceasefire now on the state of Israel. We cannot allow authoritarian leaders to be the rulers of the day and listen without question. I will continue to question. You know, I'm glad that the other Canadian provinces outside of Daniel Smith are starting to work more collaboratively together. This is a very serious time. We know we know that history can repeat itself. I think it's a very serious time, and it requires a very serious, measured response.
In 2006, Canada joined the U.S. NORTHCOM, and it's been argued that this basically allows for NORAD to have jurisdiction over land, over air and space, but also land and sea, and that a U.S. general can essentially, you know, send to the north and all over our country troops without this explicit jurisdiction of the government of Canada. And so it seems that there's a possible conflict between being a part of this, you know, renewed NORAD and having an independent foreign policy. So how would you be able to focus the country's independent foreign policy while being a part of NORAD? Or would you have us get out of NORAD altogether?
So I think it's important to recognize that in all these discussions, you know, Canada has constitutional obligations with Indigenous peoples over lands, territories, and resources. And as we I've heard in the media and people discussing it, often it's discussed without upholding our constitutional obligations to Indigenous people, certainly, you know, in Nunavut. There was recent meetings or announcements that happened in Nunavut. Nothing can happen without the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous people. That certainly was affirmed in Bill C-15, which affirmed the application of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples into Canadian law, I think, or Indigenous peoples into Canadian law. And I think, you know, we need to have a more thoughtful discussion, a more fulsome discussion. If Canada is going to uphold the rule of law, Indigenous peoples need to be part of that discussion.
Okay. And I just touching on the question of Israel, the United Nations has recognized that the Israeli regime is an apartheid regime. And this, you know, in reference to the behavior towards the Palestinian people. And there's a lot of charges. I mean, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch have called it a genocide, what's currently happening there. And the International Court of Justice has said that the case of genocide is a plausible one. Yet the Trudeau government and the Carney government have not, to my understanding, issued any punishment or any censure or any isolation towards the behavior of Israel in the international community. I mean, you mentioned the arms embargo and the ceasefire now, but I mean, what more would you do in order to press Canada to take a stand against the behavior of Israel?
Well, I've publicly called what's happening in Gaza ethnic cleansing. I mean, it seems to me a very clear genocide. I know that the ICJ ruling has, determined that. There's arrest warrants out for Netanyahu. I think it's important. Like, you can't pick and choose when to uphold international law when it suits your political and economic interests. I think this is an example of a failure of the world. There are statements, clear statements on record that demonstrate intent. And I think it's important. Canada said it would, uphold the rulings of the International Criminal Court. They have to do that. I will continue to speak vocally around the issue. I was very, very honored to receive the endorsement from Muslim Vote. I was very honored and felt that it was important to sign up to the campaign Vote Palestine. And I will continue to be vocal on this issue. Let's not forget my own history. You know, my family was literally disseminated, decimated in the Holocaust. You know, five survivors at the end, my father. You know, and he had a very clear position about Palestine. My mother, Indigenous, a woman, Indigenous Chinese woman from Canada, you know, I put forward a motion that was received unanimous consent to recognize what happened in residential school as an act of genocide. You know, when you turn a blind eye to these horrific events, it has lasting intergenerational impacts as a result of the Holocaust. I grew up void of family. And, you know, as a result of what my mother went through, I come from a family with a very complex, traumatic history of violent colonialism. I can't stay silent about that.
Just finally, is there anything you'd like to say that maybe we haven't touched on yet that addresses any of the points that we've raised in this conversation?
No, I think it's important at this time. I mean, we spoke about really complex issues in this interview, and I think at this time it is critical to elect folks that have experience, that have a proven track record actually working across party lines to get things done, including things like the red dress alert system, including things like recognizing what happened in residential schools as an act of genocide, including having record investments in Winnipeg Center. I hope to have the honor to continue doing that.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
So I'm Donald Grant. I'm running in the People's Party of Canada in the Winnipeg Central riding. And I'm just there to help the people and work for the people and, you know, make this country a little better and people to live better, work better, and just, you know, work for the people and change, make a change, basically.
Okay. So presently, the country is being threatened by Donald Trump. I mean, he's leveled tariffs against our country and has been threatening annexation of our country. And a lot of people feel that, you know, maybe we should be canceling our purchasing of arms from the U.S., including the F-35 fighter jets, the air reconnaissance crafts, the refueling jets, the drones, and the naval destroyers. So I'm wondering if you could maybe explain where you and your party stand in terms of putting a halt on the purchase of all U.S. Military arms.
So as far as purchasing any goods from the U.S., our party doesn't, we don't stand for tariffs. We don't think it's right to issue tariffs on anything, any goods on either side. And we just want to promote good economic development and social partnering and not hurt our allies. Like, we should be allies. And, you know, if we're helping each other buying jets and fuel, then we should buy jets and fuel, but not being tariffed on those goods.
Okay. You know, the United States under Donald Trump is threatening our country, and yet we are part of an organization called NATO, which the United States leads.
Yes.
So what would your stance be in terms of getting out of NATO, or whether to stay in anyway? And I mean, especially considering that the NATO in recent years had led us into wars in Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, and Libya, and destroyed those countries. So what's your party's take?
So NATO for our country is a good thing, because we don't have a very big army, and we do have potential threats of all over the world. So if someone tried to invade us, like the U.S., at least we have someone to help protect our sovereignty and our nation as a whole.
Okay. There's Canada signed or entered into the U.S. Northern Command back in 2006. And this U.S. Northern Command, it actually enabled NORAD to expand the jurisdiction beyond air and space, but into land and sea. And this seems to be this seems to have concern us that the United States can move troops into our territory, into our north, and without the explicit support of the Canadian government. It's just, you know, active within the U.S. Northern Command. So do you have does this not create a conflict between having an independent foreign policy? I mean, how do we pursue that without getting out of NORAD, or should we get out of NORAD?
So I think any country trying to potentially come into our territory or waters is not right, and it should be a protected thing within NORAD or NATO, whatever it should be. So Russia or any other country not to come in our sovereign nation's territory, and there should be some type of law or protection in place to make sure this type of thing doesn't happen.
Okay, so even if Canada did not officially, I mean, the United States may make a decision that there's a threat there, they can move in there without any say from us.
So, no, there should be consultation. We should, you know, they should advise and have talks about any threats that are coming within the territory, and let Canada decide for themselves if we want these ships or whatever in our territory, north or any other place.
Okay. Now, currently, the United Nations has decided that the state of Israel is actually an apartheid regime, and that because of their treatment of the Palestinian people, and especially recently with what Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch have called a genocide. The International Court of Justice said that the case of genocide is a plausible one. Does that not suggest that we should be taking some sort of action to prevent the genocide? Because the current the government of Justin Trudeau and now Mark Carney has not actually punished or censured or isolated Israel in the international community in any way. Is there something that you could do or you could argue to, you know, prevent the what they're calling a genocide in Palestine?
So I feel in any way, shape, or form, genocide is wrong, no matter what. So if there's certain ways that as a country we could help, I think it's maybe a good thing. And genocide is just not acceptable, and it shouldn't, we should never have to, anyone should never have to live that, or any country be invaded. So I think the government could help out in a way, but at the same time, you know, we need to, you know, reduce our government and save money and not give so much foreign aid to other countries, and, you know, take care of Canada first. Canada people first.
Okay. Just a final question. If you could talk about the People's Party and how that, you know, any aspects of your party platform or positions could influence the questions that I've asked throughout our conversation so far.
So our party, where we're like, take care of us first, Canada first. Our issues are here, the people, the healthcare, the natives, the grassroots people first, before we do anything outside our country. So in the long term, I don't think as a party we will be sticking our nose into places where we don't need to be.
We will feature the remaining candidates on the next show. Right now, we are bringing you back 7 years to an interview we had with David Orchard. He was an organic farmer, a political activist, the two-time contender for the now-defunct Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, and the author of the book, The Fight for Canada, Four Centuries of Resistance to American Expansionism. In this interview, he mentioned the threats to Canadian sovereignty represented by the Free Trade Agreement, alternatively called the Sale of Canada Act by its critics. Here he mentions how the decision by President Donald Trump at that time to rip up NAFTA was an opportunity rather than a crisis.
The Canadian colonies, as they were then in 1854, entered a free trade agreement with the United States. It ran for 12 years, and the Americans thought that the Canadian colonies were so integrated into the United States economically that they would ask or beg for entry into the U.S. Union. And so they canceled it, hoping to force Canada to join the U.S. And it backfired because the Canadian leaders like Thomas Darcy McGee and John A. Macdonald and George Etienne Cartier and the others sat down together and decided to confederate, to join forces, to join the colonies together in a confederation of Canada and build an independent Canadian economy, and including building the longest railway in the world. And they went ahead and did that. So instead of us joining the United States, it was a push for Canada to become an independent country. And that's the same situation we're facing today. We're facing the buy-up of our industries. Our whole economy is becoming American-owned. Even our national railways are U.S.-owned. Stelco, Hudson's Bay Company, Tim Hortons, all of those companies are bought by the United States, and they're wanting the right now to buy up many more. And we've got the Canadian government begging the Americans to extend NAFTA, saying we have to have it, and if we didn't have it, it would be a disaster. It wouldn't be a disaster at all. If Canada got out of the NAFTA, we would go back to trading with the Americans under the World Trade Organization, it's called the WTO. Over 100 countries around the world belong to it, and Canada and the United States are both members. And those are the rules that would govern our trade with the United States without NAFTA. And we did better trading under the WTO for decades before we joined the Free Trade Agreement in 1988 and then NAFTA in 1999. The Americans weren't able to put tough tariffs against our lumber exports. They weren't able to destroy the Canadian wheat board. They weren't able to buy up our country in the way that they're doing. So if we got out, we would simply go back to trading with the United States in the multilateral WTO forum, and we could do much better, and we could build our economy into as an independent Canadian economy. So it wouldn't be the end of the world at all.
Now, as a point of full disclosure, when you ran for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party in 2003, I was one of your delegates. And I remember you arguing not so much that you wanted to scrap NAFTA as you thought it should be renegotiated. And that's what we're seeing right now. And I note that what was recently announced by Prime Minister Trudeau is that we could walk away from the deal. This idea that that Prime Minister Harper had, better a bad deal than no deal at all. Actually, he's been clear, no, I'm not going to accept a bad deal. Better to walk away, essentially. So that must come as music to your ears.
Well, if it's sincere, yes, it does. Actually, just to go back a bit, when I was running for the leadership, I was calling for a review of the FTA and NAFTA, and whether that would have led to a renegotiation or not, or whether it would have led to us getting out of it, I don't know. But it was this renegotiation is definitely not something that I was advocating. I would like to see us simply get out of it. And if Mr. Trudeau said that he's prepared to walk away, well, that's good, except that at the table it seems that they're prepared to concede more and more. And Canada has spent millions of dollars trying to convince the Americans not to pull out of NAFTA. They've been begging, and they've hired all kinds of individuals, including Brian Mulroney, to be ambassadors to try to convince the Americans to hang on to the free trade agreement, to hang on to NAFTA. And so it puts us in a bad position, a weak negotiating position. If you've made it so clear that you're desperate to hang on to it, then the Americans will say, okay, well, this, what are you prepared to do to hang on to it? Mm-hmm. So if Canada, what Canada has to have is the backbone to step out of it. Because the things that the Americans are asking for, you know, I mentioned they've bought up so many of Canada's industries and companies. Over 10,000 Canadian companies have been bought up by American owners since these free trade deals went into place. But there were some exemptions before. The Americans couldn't buy up our health care and our education system and all of our airlines and telecommunications. But the Americans now, in their bargaining, are demanding the right to buy up all sectors, and that's a quote from their demand, all sectors of the NAFTA countries. So whatever they haven't gotten around to buying up till now, they now want the right to do that. And that would mean the end of our independence as a country. And our government has been saying, well, we want to have a more progressive NAFTA. We want to have labor rights and gender rights and all this. They can't have a more progressive NAFTA because it's all about allowing the U.S. corporations to come in and buy up our country. And that's what we're seeing happen. And so we can't have a progressive buyout of your country. We need to stand on our own 2 feet and build Canadian industries. We once built, I mentioned we built the railways. We've also built the Avro Arrow, which was the most advanced jet interceptor in the world. We built the world's first jet aircraft, the Avro Jetliner, and then we ended up destroying both of those industries, and now we pay hundreds of billions of dollars to buy American aircraft and American weaponry and American ships, and of course we build American cars. All of the things that we could do if we built our own industries ourselves and kept those funds and those jobs and the head office jobs in the country. We could imagine the kind of economy that Canada could have if we built our own and insisted on that.
David, you'd mentioned that you're not in favor of the kind of negotiations we're seeing right now, but you would have been open to the idea of renegotiation. If you have the ability to call the shots here, are there two or three non-negotiable conditions that would have to be met for you to be able to, you know, however reluctantly, accept the renegotiated NAFTA?
Well, I don't think we should be renegotiating NAFTA at all, because the whole idea of NAFTA and the free trade agreement is Canada is one-on-one with the most powerful nation in the world, and that's where we get swamped. I don't think we should be doing these direct one-on-one deals with the United States. Well, Mexico is involved too, but the United States is our main traditional competitor. And so we should be staying in the multilateral forum, and that's the WTO forum, which has, as I mentioned, dozens of countries around the world. And Canada has allies in a forum like that. We're not one-on-one up against the United States. We have allies that could help us and have helped us over the years, and the dispute settlement mechanism, of course, is much better. Under the free trade agreement and NAFTA, the Americans can challenge us in court. They can sue us for any law or regulation that they think hurts their interests and is contrary to the spirit of NAFTA. They can sue us, and they've already sued us some 40 times since NAFTA has been in place, and we've paid out $300 million in damages to the Americans. It's created a chill. All the legislation that's being passed in Canada now is all vetted to make sure that it's in line with the NAFTA agreement, and this has placed a tremendous chill on our sovereignty as a nation. So I'm saying that we should stay out of the one-on-one agreements like the free trade agreement and NAFTA with the U.S. and stay with the multilateral worldwide trade body, which has been much better for Canada.
David Orchard, I'd like to play a clip. This is from the recent town hall on January 31st here in Winnipeg. Justin Trudeau, our Prime Minister, was answering a question about prioritizing an east-west power grid. So here's a little bit about what he had to say in response to that question.
Thank you very much for your question. It's something that we've talked about an awful lot with the provinces. Obviously, the provinces have a significant role to play in this, and BC and Alberta are actually looking at better power line transmission between the two of them. I think that's a positive step. When you have, as we always do, limited funds in any government, to spend on different projects, you have to look at the ones that are going to have the best impact and the biggest case. And the case for the East-West energy grid, as opposed to other projects, hasn't been made strongly enough to make it top of the priority list. But I can certainly say there's been lots of conversations about it, and I'm always looking for opportunities to continue to improve how we're efficient on an energy basis and how we're helping each other out as best we can.
Maybe you'd like to respond to some of what the Prime Minister said, and also where you see NAFTA either enabling or impeding such a project.
Well, the idea of an east-west energy grid is something that I've been advocating for 25 or 30 years. And before me, John Diefenbaker wanted to create an east-west energy grid. The reason for that is simple. We've got our provinces now linked much more closely to the U.S. than they are to each other. When Ontario had the blackout of its electricity blackout a number of years ago, we had all of the lines from Quebec going straight south to New York, and when Ontario ended up buying their emergency electricity from U.S. coal-fired plants rather than simply having a line across to Quebec, which has a surplus of energy. Same thing with Manitoba. They're more tightly linked down to Minnesota and south of the United States than they are to their neighboring provinces. Saskatchewan here is talking about building nuclear reactors because we want to phase out our coal-fired plants. We don't even have a line that links us over to Manitoba. We should simply link over to Manitoba and buy some of their surplus and forget about building nuclear reactors in Saskatchewan. The same for British Columbia. They've got a surplus of energy, and they could supply some of the western provinces here. We should have an east-west grid that goes all the way across the country so that Canadians are looked after and have secure energy supply. We don't have that. And so if the Trudeau government is talking about it, that's good, but we need to take this beyond the talking stage and actually build it. It's similar to our oil situation. We've got Alberta oil moving south to the United States in a major way at cut rate fire sale prices, and we've got Eastern Canada, Atlantic Canada, importing oil from the United States and from Saudi Arabia and paying through their nose for it. We don't have a secure east-west link for our oil and gas either, which is what we should have. But electricity is certainly the place we could start.
Now, we were just talking about energy, and I know that NAFTA does have implications not only for our energy security, but also for our ability to take some proactive actions in reducing our contribution to climate change. Could you comment on that?
Yes. Well, we've signed in the free trade agreement first, and then repeated it in NAFTA, that we'll continue to sell to the Americans the same proportion of any energy good that they were taking, even if there's a shortage. So that means right now, for example, the Americans are taking about 60% of our oil exports. And that means if we face a shortage in this country, we would still be bound under the terms of the FTA and NAFTA to continue sending 60% south to the United States, and even if we go short ourselves. And further, that we will never charge the Americans more for any energy good than we charge Canadians. And by signing that, we really cut our throats in terms of building a competitive economy, because cheap energy was something that, abundant energy is something that we have in this country, and we should be using that to build industries here that can compete with the Americans. Instead, we've signed away the right to give the Americans our oil and our gas and our all forms of energy at the same price as Canadians. I'm not aware of any country anywhere in the world that's signed away its resources in this way. And the Americans bragged, and so did some of the progressive conservative cabinet ministers that were involved in negotiating the free trade agreement, bragged that they put this clause in there so that we could never have another national energy policy, which is a policy that the Pierre Trudeau government introduced to make to Canadianize the oil and gas industry, and was very popular with Canadians, because most Canadians want to see our oil and gas, the benefits, stay here in Canada. But by putting that clause in there, it would bind the hands of any future government in terms of being able to charge higher prices for exports. We should be selling our energy resources cheaper to Canadians and charging top dollar for everything that we export. That's what Saudi Arabia and all the other exporters do. They give their own customers a break, and they charge more on the world market. That's what Canada should do. But as you point out, the implications would mean, of course, us getting out of the straitjacket of the NAFTA and the FTA terms.
Okay, David Orchard, you've made it clear that you don't want to renegotiate it in NAFTA. You want to see NAFTA gone, and we can return to this international system of arbitrating trade disputes. And, of course, as a farmer, you are not anti-trade or even anti-free trade.
Yes, well, you make the point there that these were not free trade agreements at all with the United States. As I mentioned, the idea of giving American corporations, Canadian corporations weren't given the right to sue the Canadian government, but only American corporations have that right. And the idea of selling our oil and gas and all of our energy to the United States at these cheap prices, well, that's got nothing to do with free trade. They call it free trade, but it's not free trade. And it's really, as I mentioned, a straitjacket to tie our hands in terms of becoming a competitor with the United States. And what we need, we should take this opportunity to get out of the NAFTA and the FTA and happily do so, and then build industries in Canada. Think of what we could do if we should build our own ships. We built in British Columbia, they built the Pascat Ferry, which is a beautiful machine, a quiet machine that was built, designed in British Columbia using BC aluminum, and then it got scrapped and sold for scrap, as did the Avro Arrow that I mentioned, got cut up and sold for scrap. But it certainly proved that we can build industries and build companies that could compete with any in the world. We once had Massey Harris, Massey Ferguson, the largest manufacturer of farm machinery in the world. We had the McLaughlin car that was a world-class automobile. This is what we should do, is build these industries. Norway, for example, is a small country with far fewer resources than Canada, but they have not given away their oil and gas. They've got two publicly owned oil companies. Statoil is one of them, and they've kept the returns from their oil and gas. They've sold it on the world market at a good price, and they've invested that money, and they have over $1 trillion in their savings account now, and some of the richest social programs in the world, including free health care and dental care and a whole number of other things. In Canada, if you look at what we're facing, instead of a $1 trillion surplus, we've got over $1 trillion of debt in the federal and provincial levels, and miserly old age pensions, and no drug plan across the country. All these things that we could have if we simply kept the royalties and charged a decent price for our oil and gas and built these companies. What about the idea of having a Canadian-owned automobile? Look at Japan, how they built their auto industry into a world player. And South Korea, Sweden, other countries. Canada's got all the resources here. We got the know-how. We don't have to beg the Americans to renegotiate NAFTA and to stay in that agreement. We can build these industries and build a Canadian economy that all Canadians can be proud of and which will provide security for Canadians. Right now, we saw what happened when Sears, which of course was owned in the United States, when they decided to shut it down and throw the workers out. We've seen this happen with Stelco, when Americans came in and bought up our steel industry and then closed it down. There's no security for Canadians in that. We're essentially a colony under these free trade agreements, and we need to build our own industries so that we have security and pride for Canadians in their own country and in their own opportunities.
So you think we should just message the Prime Minister or message the media?
Yes. Well, we're encouraging everyone to write to the leaders of all the political parties, because we have no political party that's truly standing for an independent Canada and standing for putting our interests first in terms of building our economy. They're going along with this, let's please keep NAFTA. And so each one of those political leaders should get a letter, swamped by letters, actually. And if people would write to them and tell them what they think about what they're doing in terms of NAFTA, and tell them to get out, stand on our own 2 feet, build our economy in this country, and charge a half decent price for our exports, and not instead of giving them away. We're selling our oil and gas for less than world price to the Americans, and at the same time, we've got our schools that are short of funding. We've got cutbacks. We've got the programs that we should have in this country. We could have all of those if we would simply get out of the straitjackets of these agreements and build our own industries. But a letter to each one of the party leaders, all of the political party leaders, to ask them to stand up and fight for Canada.
That was organic farmer, author, and political activist from a 2018 interview on the Global Research NewsHour. Join us again in 7 days for more on Election 2025. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.